I'm delighted to have you in, familiar with your work and your success. And, of course, it was many, many years ago that I read King Rat, and of course I was pretty young in those days, but I was absolutely shocked by the conditions in that prison camp, and I've carried the memory of that that book with me all these years. And in fact, the book to me is even more meaningful than some of the books that surpassed it in sales.
Sure.
You were a British Navy officer. You were imprisoned for 3 years in that Japanese prisoner of war camp. Now, many people would consider those lost years, but you did something with those years, and they changed your life in many respects. Tell me a little bit about how those years influenced you with regard to King Rat and how they, in effect, laid the groundwork for Whirlwind.
Well, I was a teenager when that started, and of course wars are fought by teenagers. You realize that they really should be fought by the politicians and the old people who start these wars. But I was there for 3.5 years. At least I was caught in Java. I was part of the 18th Division, and our tanks and guns went, of course, to the Middle East. We were trained for desert warfare, and we went to the Far East without any guns, without any tanks, without anything. It was a normal sort of snafu. So my particular war, I lost, and it was rather boring for me because my family are historically in the Navy. One of my ancestors was John Clavell, who was a flag lieutenant to Admiral Lord Collingwood in Sovereign at Trafalgar. And in most every naval battle since that time, one of my forebears has been there, or in the Marines, or in the Army, or so on. Changi for me, of course, it's easy to be wise after the event and to discuss it cleverly after the event, but it was about as near you can get to being dead and still being alive. We had 1/4 pound of rice a day. We had a few vegetables and so on. So coming out of that experience, I was 20, just over 20 when I came out, what happens to a man between 17 and 25 more or less settles his character. So my character was pretty settled by that. And in fact, even today, so long as I can relate back to Changi, I'm in balance. Because what can they do to me that hasn't already been done to me? I never told anybody these stories, and like a lot of ex-POWs from the Far East, it was closed. We never used to talk about anything. And then in 1960, just during the writer's strike in Hollywood, I was trying to be a screenwriter-director. The strike happened, I couldn't work, and my wife said, why don't you write the Changi as a novel? I had just started talking just about a week or two beforehand, telling stories about Changi and the conditions. And so she said, well, go write a novel. I said, well, I was going to lie in the sun because you can't work, you know, so the strike's on. She said, no, go write a novel and go in the room and come out with 5 pages. Well, nobody had ever told me I could not write a novel. And so I thought to myself, what should I do? How do you go about writing a novel? And I remembered Iago in Shakespeare, you know, in Othello. Almost the first line is, he says, I'm going to get that bloody Moor if I'm going to kill him, you know. So I thought, that's good enough for Shakespeare, it's good enough for me. And I started writing King Rat, and the first line is, I'm going to get that bloody bastard if it's the last thing I do in my life. And so once I started it, it came out in a tremendous rush. The paradox I find with Changi, and whilst I remember Changi, and whilst it was my university, a university is supposedly a place of learning. It's not a place of education. So in Changi, we had doctors and physicians and rubber planters and people who were prepared to teach you anything. There's a sequence in King Rat where this fellow is giving lectures on whales and how a whale has an orgasm and how they mate and so forth, and he's going into ecstasies about this. Well, it's a true story. And of course, like all of King Rat, all of the incidents were what I witnessed or what I experienced myself or what was told to me. Of course, I transposed a lot of the incidents from Java, where I was caught, or Indonesia as it is now, and put them into Singapore. But that's the genesis of my life as a person. I have almost three sequences in my life. One is pre-Changi, then there was Changi, then there's post-Changi, and then there's pre-Shogun NBC, the TV thing, and post-Shogun on television, because that was really the thing that made my name a brand name in as a novelist, because it was up there on the screen. Of course, I was executive producer, and I did happen to rather like the idea, because it's very important in America and other places, as you know.
It was good packaging. I was talking to William Manchester, who was also a fighter in World War II against the Japanese, and he said that to this day he didn't think he could ever forgive the Japanese that he fought against. But you have a more sympathetic approach toward the Japanese, don't you?
Well, that's a paradox. I mean, I've been asked that a thousand times before. You know, if you were a POW, and I was, for 3.5 years, and if you were one of 15 that got out, which I was, how come you write the Shogun, which is supposedly, or appears to some persons, some people, to be a pro-Japanese book? I can't answer it. I don't know. I just do know that I had a friend who was a journalist, and he told me, he said, when you're young, it's so easy to be a reporter, because you can see only two sides of the question. It's either right or it's wrong. It's black or it's white. It's yang and yin. There's no bleeding between them. And he said, as I've gotten older, I've suddenly seen that those shades of grey. And he said, the older you get, the more tolerant you get, and you can begin to see the other person's point of view. I mean, from my point of view, I was from a soldiering family. That was the purpose of other boys in my family to go into services. And I was very irritated myself that I lost my war. I really did lose my section of the war. And the Japanese treated us terribly badly because I didn't realize it at the time. According to their code, the worst possible thing that a soldier could do is to capitulate. And we did, in about 100,000 troops all through Asia capitulated. They didn't. And so naturally, as a soldier, I had a great admiration for them. And after the war, I should jump forward in time, really, because the reason Shogun came to pass was I wanted to write a story after I'd finished Taipan. I wanted to write about the big story, Japan-China. China vis-a-vis Japan, Japan vis-a-vis America, because the weight of the world used to be in Europe before the war. Then it came in the 50s to America, I mean the political weight of the world. And now it's shifted out. We've lost it. And now it's in the Pacific area. It's China, Asia, Russia, which of course is different from European Russia, and Taiwan and Korea and all of those places. So I wanted to write a story about Japan-China. I knew nothing about Japan, so I started reading about it. And all of a sudden, I said, God, this is bloody good. And this is interesting. And I found the stories of the three great generals, Hideyoshi, Nobunaga, and Ieyasu, who I called Toranaga. And then I learned about their lives, and I got to be interested in that. And then a line in one of my daughter's school books said, in 1600, an Englishman went to Japan and became a samurai. Well, for a storyteller, you've got to say, who was he? What did he do? What happened? Did he get married? Was this beautiful bird in his life? Who was it? How did he get there? I never knew, and so forth. So eventually I tracked down the man, of course, was Will Adams. And out of this, I decided I might as well learn something about Japan, because writing for me is a learning process. I mean, when I started Shogun, I didn't realize that SJ meant Society of Jesus. I mean, I was so naive. But in the process of researching, in the process of reading, in the process of doing this, I started to learn an awful lot about Japan. I mean, so much so that I was entertaining a group of PhDs who were all Japanese teachers who wanted to come see me when we were making Shogun. And they wanted to know how I knew so much about Japan. And these five, one of whom was a lady, all professors of Japanese history, and they said, well, how did you know that this daimyo, this leader, was a leper? I'd say, well, I probably read the same stories that you read. And they said, oh, no, it's impossible. And they said, well, how did you know about this? And why did you change the names from Tokugawa to Torunaga? And obviously, Mariko is Gracia Hosokawa. So I said, oh? Well, it wasn't at all, but they believed it. And they, eventually, one of them said, angry, how do you know so much? Furious with me. So I said, well, you see, I was there. And there was a deadly hush, and this woman said, ah, I knew you believed in reincarnation. So whenever I get backed into a position now, I can say, well, you see, I was there.
Well, what you have done, I believe firmly that you have probably done more to tell people about the past than most historians have done, simply because the vast majority of people are not going to go and look for scholarly journals or histories. They are going to find works that they can read that are accessible to them. And that is our learning process.
Sure.
That's the way we learn.
But of course, this is a story, you see, to begin with, so that people's minds are more open. They don't have to go to a class. Nobody's teaching them anything. I'm just telling them a story. But en route, the things that have interested me, I put in. For instance, I put in a lot about the Quran in Whirlwind, and I put in a little about Islam, and a little about Ayatollahs and Mullahs, so that perhaps after the reading of that particular book, you may understand the world headlines better. But it's not a lecture, and it's things that interested me.
Well, more than world headlines, also about the Iranian bathroom habits, which I found fascinating.
Yes. Well, it's not only Iranian. I mean, that is the way that 90% of the world, they squat. They don't have toilets. They don't have running water. They don't have electricity. And they have to squat. I mean, they don't have seats to sit on. So we are in an absolute minority. They do it the correct way, in their opinion. Do you follow?
Let's go back a little bit. After the war, you became involved in the film business. How did that come about?
Oh, that came about because I was tossed out of the services, permanently unfit, because I had a buggered knee, and so I couldn't stay in the services. And I wanted to do something. I didn't know quite what I wanted to do because I was trained for nothing else. I was trained to be in the services. What do you do? I mean, I was so blinkered in from my school and from my upbringing that I wondered what the hell people did if they did not go into the services, of course, as officers, you know, I mean, of course. But that was just my sort of training. I got into it because I went and saw a director operating at Pinewood Studios. A friend of mine took me down there. And I saw this nasty little man who had this enormous power. And he sat in the seat and he beckoned the leading lady over, and she was suitably polite, and he was very rude to her, and he sent her away with some nasty remark. He called over the leading man. Then he said, quiet, quiet. And then the cry was taken up by his minions. And then eventually he said, okay, let's go. And so dead quiet and action, he said quietly. And then it went on, he said, cut! And everybody went into shock, you know. I thought it was a wonderful way of life. So
ordering people around.
Well, I was used to ordering people around, but not with so much dignity. So I saw this operating, and then I discovered that how you get to be a director is obviously somebody gives you the job. To get the job, I discovered you had to be the producer. To be a producer, you have to have a property, which means you either purchase something, like a book like Whirlwind or Taipan or whatever, or you have a screenplay. So I stole a couple of screenplays and saw what a screenplay looked like, and I started to try and write screenplays. And then when I came to the States from England, I went to Hollywood, and they said, what do you do? And I said, well, I'm a screenwriter. And I, of course, if you say it with my accent, it sounds as though it's right. at least it sounds authoritative.
Of course, I can't imagine someone with your accent writing a movie with a title like The Fly, but was that the classic movie?
Oh, yes,
the
absolutely.
Classic?
That was my first screen credit. That was when I discovered I was a screenwriter because my peers said it was a smashing screenplay. And
you acted against type for that one.
Well, I guess so. But listen, you know, in this world, you try to survive. Thank God for America. 100% of my opportunities, both in the book business and in the film industry, given me by Americans. Back to the fly for a moment. One of the great moments in my life was my daughter, Holly, came back from school one day, and she was about 10, and she said, "Hey, Dad." I said, "Yes, Holly." She said, "Did you write the fly?" So I said, "Yes, I did." She said, "Did you really write the fly?" I said, "Yes, Holly." She said, "Gee." And she walked away, and I, in her opinion, had grown 9 feet. You know how it is with a father and a children?
She thought you had really accomplished something.
Oh, my God. My God. Of course, all of her friends at school had seen the fly.
And who hasn't?
I know. I love it. And David Hedison was the fly, and I've known him for a long time. And Kurt Newman, who directed it. It was wonderful because it just happened to be. We were lucky. It worked. And the Fox people took it out of the B unit and put it into the A unit. And it was an 18-day picture, you know, the first of the cinemascopes and the first of those type of pictures in color. And it worked. And it's wonderful.
Well, a moment ago you paid homage to the United States. Is that why you became a U.S. citizen?
Oh, sure. Well, I became a citizen actually in 1963, and I found by that time King Rat was out by then, and my films were getting to be well known, and I was getting up the ladder a bit, and I'm half Irish, and a bit mostly Scots, but half Irish, and I noticed that my words were beginning to be published and looked at. And I wanted the right to criticize. And, of course, a lot of English people came over here and particularly went over to Hollywood and made a lot of money and then went back to England or went somewhere else and criticized. Well, I felt that it might be rather nice to not only stay here and enjoy the wonderful things that exist in America, and they still do exist. I mean, it is still the land of opportunity, no doubt about it, because I came here with no friends and an old typewriter, and look what I achieved. It's impossible for me to have achieved the same thing in England.
Of course, you are living in the United States only part of the year, aren't you?
Yes, I am at the moment. That's because of my research. For instance, Whirlwind, I had to be in Europe because a lot of my Iranian friends were there. I've got to have access to the London libraries, which are particularly good, and it was very convenient for me. It's good for a writer because there's not too much to do other than to be to work.
Well, are you ever going to relocate back to the United States?
Oh,
on a permanent
sure.
basis?
Sure, in due course, as soon as I can. But what I'm doing is, like I've always had to do, like you probably have to do too. You have to go where the work is. I have always traveled around because my background is naval, as I was saying. My wife's family are the same naval, so we were used to traveling around.
Now, you did travel extensively in Iran, but you didn't know at that time that you were going to write a novel, did you, about Iran?
No, I went there in 1974 with a friend of mine who was in the oil business, and that's when I realized that helicopters and oil business go hand in hand. And at that time, my wife and I had fixed-wing licenses. We could fly twin-engine planes and had instrument ratings and so forth. American licenses, of course, based upon a Canadian private license because we used to live in Canada for a time. And so we decided to fly helicopters because if I was going to do anything about oil business in Iran sometime in the future, I would certainly have to, it would be helicopters.
So you actually learned to fly a copter, huh?
Oh, absolutely. I used to fly the 47 G2. I haven't flown one for a couple of years. But if necessary, I could pick it off the ground and sort of limp into the air and more or less put it down in one piece. Strange enough, did you by chance hear about the Chinook that went in?
Yes, in the North Sea.
I was at Aberdeen last Thursday, and I had gone out to one of the rigs that they pick people off on because my research for Whirlwind, I used to go out on the rigs in the North Sea and went to Aberdeen and the places, of course, that I'd write about. And that was very sad.
It's hard to imagine helicopters being so big to carry all those
46
people?
People went in. Yeah. 46 people dead, you know. And they had no time even to inflate their life jackets.
Now, the publicity given to the $5 million purchase price to Whirlwind, does that not, do you think, detract attention to the literary aspects of the work? Or does the reader, in effect, pay no attention to things like that?
Well, it's a hell of a good story for newspapers, and don't forget, newspapers are in the business to sell newspapers, so, you know, it makes a good story. The money notwithstanding, I can guarantee you that any of my readers, anybody who's enjoyed any of my books, will relish Whirlwind, because it's as good as I can do. I haven't sloughed it off. I've not disappointed anybody, and it exists, and it's there. So, as far as the money is concerned, you know, I mean, I've been asked that before. It's really not important. It's certainly not important to me. I don't particularly need 1,000 pairs of Gucci shoes. I just need one.
It's like having more salt than you need, I guess.
Yes.
I suspect you can only use so much salt.
Well, the government likes it.
Oh, yes. Well, one thing I like in terms of the design of Whirlwind, I like the maps that preceded each
yes.
chapter. That was very helpful, especially about a country that I didn't know very much about in spite of the publicity incumbent about
sure.
Iran. One thing I could have used, the book is so big and there's so many characters, I could have used a listing of some of the characters and their titles and
sure.
associations. That would have been helpful just to refer to, especially if you put the book down for a day and
yes.
you go back. That would have been helpful. This book is more than 1,200 pages. Matter of fact, all of your books, with the exception of King Rat, are large books. Now, what are the problems as a writer in creating a work as big as that? Because obviously there must be an inordinate amount of organization to do something on such an immense scale.
Well, there is and there isn't. You see, I don't have a pattern. I start in the beginning, and when I've actually decided to write something, I do about a year of research. Then, having done that, one day I go into a nausea of trying to start it. It's the opening line, the opening page, the opening sentence. What is it, you know? And I go through months of sort of agony of what it is, and never really putting anything down. Then one day it all begins. And in this case, the tip of the sun touched the horizon. You know, it's at sunset. And that began the thing. So, Whirlwind revealed itself to me more or less in the way that the reader reads it. I mean, I saw this picture of this man on the mountainside, and I watched what he did, and I watched him pick up the gun and blaze it off at the helicopter, shrieking, "Satan!" You know, and that's in just the first few lines. And then what was happening in the helicopter? I knew, of course, that I wanted to write a story about a multinational group of helicopter pilots who were caught in this revolution just after the Shah has left and just after Khomeini has returned, long before the whole hostage crisis. That had nothing to do with it. That were torn up in this revolution, which in my reading about it and my historical reading appeared to me like the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution. So these group of people are caught up in it. And if you want to write an epic story, an epic in its truest sense, I don't mean badly, you put ordinary people into extraordinary circumstances, and then you watch what's going to happen to them.
But about the creative aspects, you can't just knock this off the top of your head. It required an enormous amount of research, obviously. Plus, didn't you have to outline this so that you knew your characters were going to go from one point to another point to another point and wind up here?
No. No, I know you're not going to believe me, but the fact is that I don't. I start off the story, and the story grows. And I knew that I had to have, say, a Frenchman, a French pilot. And I'd done a lot of historical, a lot of research on French people. I lived in France for a while. You know, I wanted to learn about French, you go live in France. I wanted to write about a German. I've been to Texas. One of my Americans is Texan. You know, I had lived in Texas and so on. And you put all of these things into your head and you sort of roll it around. And then you start to work. And the work consists of thinking. And so I know that I'm going to have this fellow shot at this aircraft. Did it go down? Now I go into the aircraft and I see, no, it didn't go down. The aircraft is full. Who are the passengers? So I have to wait and look in my mind, in a reverie, so to speak, who's in the airplane. And gradually these things start growing. The airplane's going something. I knew that I wanted to write about 5 or 6 particular locations in Iran. One I called Zagros, the Zagros Mountains, because Zagros is a beautiful word, and it sort of thrilled me and sends shivers down my spine, because Zagros, you know, it sounds dramatic and good. So they're going to Zagros 3. So when I wrote the sequence about the people arriving there, I didn't know what was going to happen. And then suddenly, out of the blue, they listen, and the sound of machine gun fire is coming from the village that's nearby. And you turn the page, and it's a new chapter. And I thought to myself, God, what's happening? And then by that time, I had to get on with this particular sequence. The maps are very useful. The list of names we didn't put in deliberately, because if you need it, then I've failed. Because I have to keep your interest, so that pretty soon you will know Eric, he is in Tabriz, and so on. But there is no pattern. What I do is I keep a synopsis, a running synopsis in reverse. So after I've written something, I say chapter 1 consists of so-and-so, so-and-so, so-and-so. And then when I've done chapter 2 consists of so-and-so, so-and-so. But while I'm doing that, I might say, God, that's a great idea. I might have a sequence, something to do with a radar base on the Soviet-Iranian border. Because I read a piece in a paper that some Americans had evacuated one of these overt or covert radar stations. So I put that aside. Then I start writing. And all of these things happen.
The storytelling process, that is really a mysterious one, isn't it?
Well, it's so mysterious that I'm looking at you now and I'm seeing Whirlwind on there. And I can refer to it as a wonderful book, because it's not mine, you see. It's gone. I can't recreate it. It's impossible. I find it inconceivable that I did it, because I don't know how it happened. It is true. I started writing November 22, 1982, and I finished it the first time in July of last year, and the second time October, and the third time just before I came over here for this famous auction, you know. However, having done it, After January through May, I was heavily rewriting with my editor, which, of course, rewriting, as you know, is the art of writing. And that's a wonderful time for me, because it exists. It's got a top page, it's got a bottom page, and you can pare it and polish it and so on. But now that it exists in the book form, there it is. And I cannot believe, truly, that I did it. I did it. Yes, I did. How did I do it?
It's like reading a book written by someone else, except you're not going to take your name off that.
Hell
that
no.
Jacket. You said something interesting about the editing process. I've read somewhere in some of the propaganda that about you, various publicists have sent in, that you had a difficulty in wanting to be edited. But obviously you tell me that's not the case.
Well, it's cobblers. It's cobblers, we call it in English, which means nonsense. I mean, I could put it more vulgarly if you wish, but I guess I'd be bleeped. But it's nonsense. I never said that. And I never have. And for anybody in the publishing world to believe it, they're twits. I mean, they're crazy.
Do you work easily with an editor?
I've only had two editors, and one was Herman Golub, who is with Doubleday now, and the other is Gene Bernkopf. Herman did King Rat, Taipan, and Shogun, and Gene did Noble House and The Whirlwind. And all you have to do is, if you're a publisher, you call up the editor.
They've stuck with you.
What's this guy Clavel like? And I know absolutely, I've said it 100 times publicly, how important rewriting is. Because of course it is. And somehow this report got out. And it's, the nice thing is it sent some Twits into absolute total hysteria. And they're still in hysteria. And I never said it at all.
I've read somewhere within the past week or two, some publisher was being quoted as saying, well, readers don't like big books. They want something that they could read in an hour or two, or a couple of hours, a few hours of mystery, something like that, and then they can go on to something else. Well, I don't think that's true, and I think that you have proved them wrong. But in reading a James Clavell book, there is a commitment involved, not only the price of the book, which is an expensive book for a novel, but its length. So there is a commitment there that one doesn't have if there's a little thin paperback that you can indeed read and then trash when you're through with it.
Well, there are two answers to that. Is number one, I write short stories. They may appear big in size, but when you consider it, it's 4 or 5 or 6 novels in one. Whirlwind, for instance, 1,100 pages or whatever it is. Is it interesting? And in return for picking up one of my books, I think I'm trying to, well, I know I am trying to give them value for money because conservatively, and the average reader would spend 2 or 3 weeks perhaps reading one of my books. And what I'm trying to do is, the goal of writing any book is to create the illusion that what you are reading is reality and that you're part of it. I mean, I've been told by people who have read my books, they start reading very fast, and then they start getting slower and slower, and they start rationing themselves. And the only complaints I've ever had, say, with Shogun, is that it's too short. Now, it sounds crazy, but if in this world you can entertain people and open their eyes to a little things that they may never, never, ever experience, it's quite possible after reading Whirlwind, you might have the feeling that you've been to Iran. Certainly after Shogun, people think that they can speak Japanese.
Well, to kind of wrap things up, there's another side of James Clavell. And I do have the book. I stupidly left it at home today when I came to work. But it's a new book for children called Thrumpomoto, I believe.
Thrumpomoto. I love that.
Tell me about that book.
Well, I mean, it was Thrumpomoto. It's a wonderfully illustrated book by a man called George Sharp in England. And it's an exquisite book. And it was one of those things that I wanted to do myself. And actually what I did is I got it photocopy ready, I think they called it, and then offered it to the publisher. So that I did it in my way. I found the artist that I wanted and paid him for a year while he was doing all of these designs. And it was wonderful to get involved with it because I'd never written a children's story before. I'd written the children's story but not for children, but that was something entirely different. But anyway, one day I met a fellow, my Australian publisher, and he said, why don't you write a children's story? And I said, well, I don't write children's story, you know. He said, well, think about it. I said, thanks very much, but I've got enough problems. I think I was writing Noble House at the time. I've got enough problems writing Noble House. And he said, well, think about it. A year or so passed. And he said again, why don't you write a children's story? He said, I can sell 100,000 books in Australia because it's a good market for children's books. So I said, oh, okay, well, I'll think about it. And one day I was in England, and I was looking out of the window, putting myself into this reverie that I like to sort of spend time in. And I saw this bundle fall out of a tree opposite. It was an oak tree, actually. And then, in my mind, I saw this little ball unwind itself to the cutest little Japanese boy you could ever see. And he was only about 2 feet high, and he was wearing a multicolored kimono, and sparkles were falling off him. And then I noticed this little girl nearby, and she said, good day, with an Australian accent. And then the tree became a jacaranda tree, and he said, she said, who are you? She said, well, my name's Thrumpomoto. And he said, may I ask your name? And she's looking down at this little character peering up at her from the grass. And she is in the outback in Australia because, unfortunately, Thrumpomoto is an apprentice wizard. And he made a mistake with his trick, And instead of whizzing to sea, because wizards whizz, you know, they go from A to B by whizzing, not by cars. Instead of whizzing to his grandfather in the hills, he ends up in the outback of Australia at the feet of this little girl. And he says, well, my name's Thrumpamoto. I'm a wizard. At least my mother's a wizardess. How old are you? And she says, well, I'm seven. I'm almost seven. And he says, oh, well, I'm 493. And she says, well, you don't look 493. He says, oh, well, 493 in wizard time. That's about seven. And it turns out that little Patricia has been scratched by Nerku the Bad. And they go off on this noble quest to try and find the cure for her and meet characters like Charlie Rednose Beer Drinker. And again, I don't know where all of these names come from, and I don't know where it comes from, but the manuscript itself is only 32 pages, and the book itself is only, I think, about 90 pages, gorgeously illustrated, where the pictures are integrated somehow into the words themselves, which was our idea. And it's a beautiful book, and Good Conquers Evil.
Has it been published? It has been published in Australia.
Yes, it's published by Delacorte. It's just out.
In Australia?
No, it's out here.
So it is. It was not published in Australia first.
No.
So the Delacorte edition is the...
Correct.
The so that's out this month as well.
Yes, it is.
Well, that's certainly going to surprise your readers. Did you... you must have finished that at the end of one of the chapters of Whirlwind, huh?
Yes, I...
A little bored, and so you decided you would knock off the children's book after all these thoughts came to you while looking out the window?
Well, I'm never bored with what I do. I enjoy life so much, and that goes back to Changi. You know, and it's this moment between you and me here will never, ever be repeated in its... ever, right? So it's necessary to enjoy the moment, and it's to enjoy today. And going back to Changi, that's what we were taught, because during that time we had to face ourselves. You have to face yourself, that this is your face, this is who you are, this is what you're going to be. You have to face it. It's a little homily or a little thing that I put in Thrumpamoto, that whilst you can have a wizard and whilst you can do tricks and there are magic things and there is magic in the world, magic sometimes needs a helping hand. You've got to help yourself. Even wizards need help.
Well, now, Whirlwind is finished, and you're in the process of taking care of some of the business aspects of the book. But many writers I have talked to have complained that writing is a very difficult job for them. They approach it with dread. They don't like to do it, but it's something that they can do, and it's something they have to do. What about you? When you have finished a book, do you look forward to starting a new one, or do you relish the idea of being free with this book and having time to spend any way you want to?
Well, after I finished King Rat, I met this fellow, and he said, anybody can write a bestseller. It's the number two that really separates the men from the boys. So I said, oh, all right, and I did Taipa. And I met the same fellow down the same street, and he said, anybody can do it twice. You'll never do it again. So I said, all right, well, up you. I wrote Shogun, right? This fellow's still around. He says, Whirlwind, phew. He says, what are you going to do next? I say, I'm not going to tell you. Are you going to do the next book? He says, absolutely. I don't know. For me, it's not boring. It's a way of life. And it's astonishing that these things exist. I mean, I am astounded that people tell people about my work, which makes them bestsellers. I mean, I don't make a bestseller. I try and write a story.
Well, I'm delighted that you wrote Thumpamoto and also the children's story, which was published several years ago. I believe that wasn't that originally printed in Ladies and Journal?
Yes, it was.
So those are different sides of you, and they're short, they're small. But it's not always necessary to keep topping yourself. I think Whirlwind is your largest book to date. Does the next book have to be even bigger than Whirlwind, or can you say, look, you're a storyteller. I'm going to tell a story, but it doesn't have to be massive. It could be a small story. It could be a James Clavell story.
Well, that is answered by Thrumpamoto, which is a story. It has a beginning, a middle, and an ending. And all stories, good stories, have a beginning, a middle, and an ending. And if they're any good, the ending is a beginning, strangely enough, by paradox. For instance, if I get killed this afternoon, that's not the end of the story. It's what happens to my children, or my wife, or you, or perhaps this broadcast, you know? What happens to that? Does it become an archive, or whatever? So the end of a story is always a beginning. I'm not trying to top myself. What I am trying to do is that if I do an interview, I try and make it the best I can, the Japanese thing, do best. And if you're always trying to do your best, whatever it is, isn't that what life is all about? With books, I would like to try and write another book. I think I probably will. And if I write a book, I do not wish to disappoint anybody that's ever read any of my books and recommended it.
Well, I don't think there are very many people you've disappointed. It's certainly a treat for me to have you here, and I have enjoyed Whirlwind. I'm not quite finished with it. I thought I would be finished in time for the broadcast, but I see
relish it. It's going to take a long time to make another.
That's right. Well, I'm working my way through it. James Gravel, it was marvelous having you here. I thank you very, very much. I know you probably have a huge schedule. And are you going coast to coast?
Yes, and then, of course, I'm going to Canada, and I've just come from England. And then, in due course, I have to go to Paris and Finland and all places east, north, west, and south.
Well, I'm glad that you spent 45 minutes with me, and I certainly appreciate it, and I wish you the best.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you very much.